Welcome and thank you for joining us on the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast, where we want to give you tips on staying healthy and even expose common myths about health and aging so you can enjoy a healthier and active life in the amazing South Sound. Brought to you by Dr. Jennifer Penrose, owner of Penrose & Associates Physical Therapy.
So today our focus is when someone should consider seeing a naturopathic physician and discussing some of the common myths and even discussing some of the specialized services that you provide. So I'm looking forward to this, just to shed more light on this. I get questions all the time about this.
Well, I hope I can help answer them for you.
So tell us a little bit about your background, where you went to school, how you decided to go into your area of expertise, maybe even delineate what is a naturopathic physician and their training in terms of how that's a little different. So I'll let you kind of dive into that for a bit.
Well, I am a Washington native. I've lived here almost my entire life. And I went to school, got my Bachelor of Science degree at Evergreen, which was actually an awesome education compared to the people that I've gone to school with. I think they did really well. And then I, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with my science degree. And when I learned about naturopathy, it seemed like a really great fit in that it seemed like a fairly ethical way to help people and be creative at the same time. But I was also very concerned about the fact that you had to start a business in order to make a living. There aren't a lot of jobs available and the scholarship money was really sparse. So it took me a few years to move forward with that. But after I proved to myself that I could pay back my undergrad loans quickly, I decided, heck, let's do this. It just seemed like a good adventure and it has been. I went to NUNM in Portland, which is the National University of Naturopathic Medicine, which is the oldest school in existence for naturopathy. They survived the spare years after the AMA, in conventional medicine basically kind of assumed dominance in the medical profession because there had been schools previously. So they survived through that and they've been around since 1956. And after, decades of bumpy existence, they, finally finalized into a university, a certified, university. So I got my doctorate there. And I think for me, it was a great fit. The NUNM isn't as well known as Bastyr. They call Bastyr the Harvard of naturopathic education. So since there's only a few schools, I'll say that NUNM is the Stanford of naturopathic schools, just because no one's going to stop me. But yeah, Dr. John Bastyr, the namesake for Bastyr, actually graduated from NUNM back when it used to be NCNM. So that's kind of the history of that school. And for me, it was a really good location being in Portland and the community there was great. And I think my education was there. There was also great, partially because I put a lot into it. It was not an easy decision, going this far in debt for an education that promised an uncertain financial security. That was a big question for me, but luckily it's all worked out for me too. As far as the education with going through naturopathic schools, we are licensed in, I think, about 20 states now. It's constantly changing because they're constantly lobbying for licensure. And licensure is really what the profession needs, because you can go to an unlicensed state and see somebody who calls themselves a naturopath, who puts on a white coat and, runs diagnostic labs that aren't really diagnostic labs and sells lots of supplements. So, in order to safeguard people from unsavory practices and unscrupulous providers, licensure and regulation is really the path forward. But because we're only licensed, in certain states, where insurance coverage differs from state to state, here in Washington, we're really lucky to be covered, as primary care, but that does not count for Medicare, because that's a national program. But the education, basically, academically, in order to get into naturopathic school, you pretty much have to have a pre-med degree. It's not as competitive is getting into most medical schools, but the requirements are pretty much the same. And then once you're in school, the academic portion of our education focuses on, primary fundamental sciences, microbiology, biochemistry, chemistry, physiology, anatomy, very similar to probably the academics, of a conventional medical school for 2 years. But then we're also having to learn alternative medicine simultaneously. The second 2 years of our education education are more clinical based and more based on specialty areas. A lot of that is probably a lot more academic than what a conventional med student would experience. It's a lot more book reading, and that has to do with the fact that we aren't really allowed into hospital settings for the most part. There's a few hospital institutional, you know, organizations that do have naturopaths integrated into their programs, but for the most part, it's mostly lip service. So that's where I think, you know, our education has a long way to go, is, you know, incorporating naturopaths into a conventional medical system, which I really feel like would benefit the conventional medical system as well as naturopathy. But we really don't have hospital privileges. We don't get to do rotations, generally speaking. Our clinical education, you know, is basically a general practice that from the school. They had a lot of community outreach clinics also. So we got to deal with acute problems for underserved populations in Portland. But overall, you know, missing that, the rotations, and, you know, when a naturopathic student graduates, they can either go directly into practice or they can seek residencies, which are few and far between and very competitive. And I was fortunate. I had two different residencies that I was able to participate in. And then I also spent a lot of my preceptorship time. So a lot of our education comes from doing preceptorships and internships, shadowing different doctors. And we have a number of hours that we have to do that. And I really lucked out. I had some excellent integrated MDs that I've been able to work with, you know, MDs that have been doing this before there was a word for it. They didn't ever call themselves integrated because that didn't exist. So I've had some awesome mentors that have kind of taught me the importance of having, you know, a good practice strategy and discipline, and then also learning much more about the standard of care for conventional medicine also, because you can't really be a primary care doc without having some kind of standard of care. You know, that is one difference with naturopathy, is that because everyone practices somewhat differently, even diagnostic standard of care may be different between practices. But, you know, for me personally, I've always felt, and professionally, I just feel like the standard of care for diagnosis should be the standard of care, regardless of what kind of provider you are. So, you know, trying to stay up to date with that has been important. And then that's the other thing with naturopathy, is there's not a standard of care necessarily for treatment other than one dictated by legal negligence, you know? So that's also, you know, it's a problem in the profession. And it's one of the things that makes the profession great, in that it's wide open, but it also potentially leads people to, you know, not have their diagnosis or their treatment be adequate. So, you know, that's something people need to be aware of when they choose a naturopath, you know, where they're coming from. I hope that answers that question.
It does. Yeah. There's a term there that some people might not realize, like integrative medicine, yeah, functional medicine. Do you want to kind of explain what that means?
I wish I knew what that meant. I don't know what that means. I don't think it means anything. And I think that's part of the problem, is it doesn't mean anything. As far as I'm concerned, there's good medicine and there's bad medicine. And, yes, you know, half of what I do as a naturopath is the stuff that the conventional doctor should have done. But with 5 minutes to 10 minutes per visit, there's no time.
Correct.
They might throw somebody a couple pieces of paper about a healthy diet, but that doesn't help somebody who eats out of a microwave. So, you know, really educating people and holding their hand, things that the insurance company doesn't really value, is what personally I spend a lot of time doing. And I think a lot of naturopaths do spend a lot of time.
I guess when I think of the word integrative and functional, it's like the whole person, right? Like,
yeah,
looking at the diet and the nutrients and the vitamins and the just different lab values that you're looking for that,
right,
potentially a family doctor
might not
look at.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that would be one definition of, you know, functional medicine also is kind of a medical trend. And I mean, I have my personal opinions about it because and this is one of the downfalls of alternative medicine, is that it quickly becomes a good way to sell supplements. And if that's a huge part of your provider's profit base, then there's some ethical concerns there. You might not be getting the best treatment. You might be getting the treatment based on what they need to sell off the shelf. And that goes with conventional medicine too now, especially with the profit margin for biologics that are so popular.
I read a little bit on your website that you even went through some cancer yourself. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that and how that shaped you and treating patients going forward?
Sure. Yeah. So at 43, I was diagnosed with colon cancer after having symptoms for, you know, quite a while, and I suspected something was very wrong, but everyone told me not to be crazy, including several conventional providers, like, you're fine, don't be crazy. But I finally forced one of my mentors, who also happened to do scopes in office, like an old school primary care doctor who does everything instead of refers everything out. I begged him to do a sigmoidoscopy on me. And then the next thing I heard was the word mass and biopsy. And then he couldn't look at me directly in the eyes for the rest of the visit. So I knew something was very wrong. And then the biopsy came back negative. So I was really happy and then spoke to him on the phone. He said, no, you need to go get a full colonoscopy because the looks of that thing. And at that point, I went and got my colonoscopy. And then the doctor who did the colonoscopy while I was still waking up from my sedatives threw the pictures of the mass in my lap and said, you need to see an oncologist now. And I said, okay. And then he said, no, now. And I said, okay. He said, no, now. So he ended up calling the primary care, and then I had my appointments, but it took a month for them to get me to oncology. So lessons that you learn as a patient, you know, sometimes you really have to advocate for yourself and risk not being liked by your providers and your insurance. But I finally got fully worked up, diagnosed, treatment. You know, actually, the funny thing is that, you know, for a while, I kind of thought, hey, well, you know, I'm a doctor and I'm pretty clever. I should be able to fix this. And, you know, that quickly dissipated as I looked at this, you know, 19 centimeter mass, you know, in photographs, and I knew it needed to go, and I didn't know anything that was going to take care of it for certain. And I knew also that my odds of survival, if I did conventional treatment, were anywhere from 50 to 70% because I had stage 3C. So that's like right on the edge of basically being on treatment for the rest of your life and then dying with the cancer. So I was extremely fortunate. You know, being a physician, I also knew that I had to go somewhere that had the best surgeons. And so, you know, I lucked out and found a great surgeon at the UW. And, you know, he was able to take the mass out, and I had a bag for 6 months. I mean, it was a very traumatic experience that went on and on and on and on, but now it's been, you know, 7 years and no sign of it. So, you know, I made the right decision. You know, I quickly learned, because one of the first things I did was I took all my supplements and I lined, you know, I probably made a 10-foot line of supplements, everything I thought I needed to take. And that lasted for about 3 days. And I was like, no way. No way I'm going to choke down all these pills. And so, you know, I relied on the conventional treatment. And, you know, this is where, like, to me, integration means something, is like being able to look at that, their treatment, look at the potential side effects and the potential problems, and then do research and figure out, you know, how do I protect myself? What kind of things are going to get me through this and increase my odds of surviving? And I thought, you know, this is very valuable because, you know, despite common misunderstandings, there is plenty of evidence for alternative medicine. It's just ahead of the curve, because once it's proven, then it becomes conventional medicine. And then oftentimes it also becomes more expensive. You know, so there are plenty of things. Yeah. And, you know, there's just plenty of things that I've seen go through the primary research and percolate all the way up to becoming a drug and then becoming unaffordable. You know, a lot of times they think, like, if you have a good naturopath, you know, they're ahead of that curve a little bit. And there's plenty of things that can be helpful without decreasing your odds of survival or the effectiveness of the drugs, but actually increasing both.
I mean, good thing you stuck with it. You knew something was not right.
Yeah.
And that's, I often say that to my patients. I'm like, you live in that body. You know it's not right. Then we need to keep at this and figure out what the true root of this is.
It's true. Yeah. Denial is a, you know, powerful medicine itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of want to move on to some myths that a lot of us out there, I think, have. I think it's safe to say that many people just think of seeing a naturopath as like the last stop, the last hope, like they've tried XYZ. And I'm sure you that's like a common thing with a new patient that you get. Do you find that that's really, really true on the majority of your clients? Or is that something in my head that I keep thinking mm-hmm. about?
It's a mix. It's a mix because, you know, we get people like that who are desperate and sometimes you can, you know, figure out what's going on. Sometimes there is no objective measurement or evidence or diagnosis. And so, you know, for naturopathy, one of the reasons why it's always helpful in my mind is that there's no condition that I can think of that isn't going to benefit from improved self-care. And if that's all we can focus on, then, you know, that's always valuable. And people really do need a cheerleader, a coach, you know, someone to teach them how to take care of themselves, because unfortunately a lot of people have missed that. But we also see people, you know, I have a number of patients that I often wonder, like, why are they seeing me when all of their problems require medications and they aren't willing to do that hard work? And sometimes I think that some people just see us because it's a more humane visit. You know, they want to be treated like a human being and, you know, not feel like they're being asked to sit and wait for an hour to get into a room, to wait for an hour to see a doctor for 2 minutes who never says hello, never looks up, and never says goodbye. So I think some people, you know, they just like the tea. You know, yeah. They like the tea in the waiting room.
The experience.
The experience, yeah. And that's fine too. But, you know, with those folks, you know, it's one of the reasons why, again, like we're trained as primary care physicians. So, you know, we can prescribe medications except for narcotics. And so, you know, if somebody needs a medication or if they need more intensive treatment and they're not willing to do some of the harder work, you know, diabetes is a good example, you know, then, you know, your naturopath should be able to also help you with prescription management or referrals.
And how come, I guess I didn't know that about narcotics, how come you can't prescribe narcotics? Is that just something?
Well, I think it's because, you know, there's going to always be a hesitation to grant new privileges. And, you know, different naturopaths in different states have different scopes of practice also. Oh,
of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're trained, you know, to perform prescriptive duties, you know, even with narcotics. And in Oregon, they actually can prescribe narcotics. I would think that the vast majority of naturopaths don't want to.
Of course not. I wouldn't think those two terms don't seem to drive, but I just was curious what that makes sense. There's certain states in physical therapy where we can't do dry needling, and other states you can.
Yeah.
And it's just a scope of practice issue.
Yeah, I'm happy not to.
Yeah, I was like, I'm sure that's a little bit of a relief
on
one hand.
It is a relief, yeah, to just tell people, you know, because there are, sadly, we have an opiate epidemic. And
yes,
you're doing musculoskeletal work, and that's so helpful for keeping people from relying on, you know, nothing but, you know, analgesics. And you know, naturopathy also, I mean, like even down to, you know, an anti-inflammatory diet, you know, there are so many different ways you can beat pain, but it does require work.
Yeah. No, there are a lot of options for managing pain in a more natural way, but it's not as quick acting as potentially. How about in terms of elaborating on a story of potentially a patient where you had to reach out and work with MDs regarding patient care? Is there something that comes to mind that would just illustrate to people listening kind of how, and it doesn't need to be a specific person per se, but maybe an example of like how you coordinate with the medical community?
In an ideal world, there'd be a lot more coordination happening. I think if you look at how conventional medicine works, there isn't a lot of communication even between, you know, conventional practitioners. You know, for us, I don't recall, you know, having an MD really want to coordinate very much with me. There are plenty of times where I reach out to them or through the patient, you know, communicate when I think that things are not being covered or, you know, standard of care is not being followed. You know, a great example would be patients, elderly patients. You know, the elderly patients, I think, oftentimes get the worst treatment, largely because the bar of malpractice and negligence is so high that practitioners oftentimes, I think, brush aside their issues. But, you know, for instance, like seeing elderly patients who have concerns about dementia, who have never had their B12 levels checked because that's considered extravagant, even though it's one of the most common causes of dementia, and it doesn't necessarily have to make your red blood cell count go down in order to be there. In fact, I think most of the people we see with B12 deficiency, their blood counts are normal. You know, that's a good example. Another good example with elderly patients is when they're on prescriptions for things like blood pressure, and then they're coming in to see me for dizziness, and you know their primary care has ignored the obvious correlation between their really low blood pressure, their blood pressure medication, and their dizziness. So every time they go to stand up, they're almost falling down and breaking a hip, and you know, having to reach out. Because, you know, I try not to step on toes either, but if their blood pressure medication's too low and they have a if their blood pressure medication is making their blood pressure too low and they have a cardiologist who's ignoring it, then either I have to change it, not knowing their full cardiology status, which, you know, could be a problem, or I need to, you know, either get a hold of that office, which, sure, you know, oftentimes, even if I call the office, I may not be able to speak with the physician. I might have to talk to their nurse, which is fine because the nurse usually might know more, right, about the patient. But, you know, reaching out to them and saying, you know, voicing those concerns. And then if they don't take care of it, I have to. But yeah, so oftentimes, I mean, I hate to say it, oftentimes that integration is really more about watchdogging, right, making sure that people are getting good standard of care conventional, right, medicine, you know, for people who are requiring those drugs.
It's easier to reach out and get a response back from a specialist, especially if it's like a surgeon, because it's their patient that they did surgery on that I need feedback on for clarification, so I don't, you know, progress something that I shouldn't progress per se. Right. Like that's an easier conversation back and forth than it is on the general side. I don't know if that's just because they've got a vested interest there. Right. They did surgery on that patient, or that I don't know if you found that like the specialists sometimes are easier to get back when there's a really particular issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, a specialist is more likely to get a hold of you. And part of that is, you know, if they're seeing a specialist, then the, whatever the condition is usually more advanced. So they've been referred to somebody who specializes to control situations that the primary care may not be adequately prepared to control. So I think that oftentimes has to do with why they do get back, is that, you know, there's more concern about that person if they've already been escalated to a specialist. I wish there was more integration and collaboration, but that model doesn't exist. I think a lot of patients expect that they go to the hospital, something's wrong with them, they're going to get to the heart of it. It's like that show House. They think that there's this team of crack doctors, you know, like evaluating everything and looking at, you know, even the most uncommon zebra to explain their situation, when the reality is that they go to the hospital, they get stabilized, they get sent home, and everyone's hoping that it's not going to happen again. But it might. So yeah, I mean, I do think, again, like I think it would be amazing if some of these conventional institutions opened up the door and, you know, asked us what we could provide, because I do think that they'd have improved outcomes, you know, if they had naturopaths involved. Instead, their patients are going to budget discount supplement stores and providers and, you know, buying based on, you know, what they're reading on the internet.
Yep. The wild, wild west when it comes to that, yeah, stuff. Yeah. It sounds like if we could just all have EMRs that would integrate with one another, yes, and we could read each other's chart notes, it would, yes, be so, I keep dreaming of the day of, yes, like, can we just all have a way to log in? I mean, that's secure, yeah, obviously, yeah, but where the EMRs will talk to one another. Right. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like with all the technology that's out there today, we can't quite get to that point.
Yeah. This is a pet topic of mine. Why doesn't the patient own their medical record?
Right.
Because there's value in compiling all of these medical records, which is why all of these different organizations are hoarding the information, and the patient has to request it and sometimes pay a lot of money to get their own record, which is their property. You know, why can't the medical record be kept on a format like Facebook, and you allow someone to visit it and see what's on it and add to it? That would be the sensible option, but not profitable.
Yeah, I know. I keep thinking, I'm like, surely we're going to get there someday, but
we'll see.
I don't know. I may not get to see that one come true. Well,
maybe we better go talk to Mark Zuckerberg about, right, that one. Yeah.
Are there any specific conditions or age groups that you don't treat? And I guess you could also answer like what you what's typical or yeah. then just, yeah, either side of that coin.
I don't see a lot of children. I am not a pediatrician, and there are naturopaths, great naturopaths, you know, especially in Olympia, who focus on, you know, children's health, and I think do a great job. I am not available 24/7, and I think a pediatrician's office needs to be. So I don't see a lot of kids. I do consultations for children, but I'm not their primary care. And then I also, you know, and I would say the same for most naturopaths, is that we are not great for urgent situations. I always like to say there's no naturopathic emergency.
Right.
So, you know, and occasionally an emergency walks in the door and I handle it or refer it out. But, you know, I don't think you should be depending on your naturopath for urgent care or emergent care. But otherwise, we see just about everything, you know, autoimmune disease, hypothyroid, fatigue, heart disease, high cholesterol, you know, the list goes on, high blood sugar, you know, hormonal issues with females and males. Menopause is a big one. You know, there's a lot of options that we have, especially, you know, with something like hormonal care, where you know, if you didn't have the option to get compounded products, you would see a lot of problems that couldn't be solved. And so I think that, you know, that's the one of the big strengths of our medicine is the creativity. There's never a lack of options. You know, if anything, there's too many options. You know, so treatment with all these different conditions and patients who oftentimes do not want the conventional standard of care, even sometimes when that might be their best option, which, you know, you try to inform them, but everyone has a right to make their own decision as long as it's an informed decision. You know, so oftentimes having to work around those limitations that the patient has put up for themselves, you know, and, you know, sometimes that requires informing the patient that they're harming themselves. And either you can convince them not to do that, or they might go somewhere else where somebody else feels okay about it.
All right. We're going to take a quick little break to hear from our sponsor.
As a listener to the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast, we're offering you a special promotion for Trim Tea. Its main ingredient is Welltrim, which is the extract of the African mango seed that has shown in studies to decrease fat by 6% if used twice a day for 10 weeks. It also decreases cholesterol, improves blood glucose, and decreases C-reactive protein, so it decreases inflammation. If you're struggling with the COVID-19, gaining the 19 pounds during COVID, that is, then this is an easy fix in addition to eating healthy. You will get healthy, tasty recipes as well with your purchase. With this special offer, you can get 3 boxes of Trim Tea for $99.99. To get this offer of Trim Tea, visit our office or contact us at 360-456-1444. That's 360-456-1444. You can also order Trim Tea online at penrosept.com. And now, back to the episode.
So we're back, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the specialized services that you provide that I thought were very interesting. So I hear a lot of times issues about sleep and lack of energy from my clients, and it's one of those where I wish I knew what else to say or ask or offer. And so what additional questions would I want to ask, or what things in terms of sleep, how do you have that discussion? How do you know what to look at next?
You know, that's a wide open topic, but you know, with quality of sleep, it really depends on, you know, what kind of problem they're having. You know, is it insomnia? Is it difficulty getting to sleep? Is it difficulty staying asleep? You know, are they having breathing issues while they're sleeping? Or do they have sleep apnea? You know, so there's some like medical considerations for sleep that, you know, should always be considered. And sleep apnea is a huge problem, especially, sure, you know, with epidemic obesity and around here, honestly, like sinus health is a big problem that we see all the time. And not only can it impact breathing and sleep, quality, but it could also potentially keep your nervous system, because basically you think about like sinuses, like there's a thin like dime width of protection with, you know, bone and mucous membrane till you get to the brain from your sinuses. So that is something that we always consider too, whether or not sinuses are impacting energy and immune function and neurological and psychological health. You know, fatigue has a basic lab workup. You know, you make sure somebody's not anemic or low red blood cell count. You make sure that their nutritional situation is adequate, specifically, you know, iron and B12 deficiencies being common.
So will those show up in the blood? Like that could be a potential.
Possibly.
Like if they've been sleep deprived.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those things might show up in the blood work.
Well, so sleep specifically. So I was speaking more about fatigue too.
Okay. Okay.
Which, you know, again, like, so like fatigue and yes. can even mask depression. So, it's, you know, hypothyroid is another, you know, for energy, but, you know, sleep specific. I think for most people, if we're talking about just straight up insomnia, maintenance insomnia is the most difficult insomnia to treat. And that is when people are waking up at 3 a.m.
And that is one of the common things I yes. hear from my aging clients is like that they wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and they cannot go back to sleep.
Yeah. Not till 6:30 in the morning. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is the most difficult one to treat for anybody, because even if you're going to use some kind of sedative hypnotic like Ambien or something, you are still likely to wake up because it's going to get you to sleep, but you may wake up in the middle of the night anyways. And so that's a really tough one. There are some supplements that I've found to be helpful. For a lot of people, there may be hormonal considerations. So, you know, menopause would certainly be something, you know, in a woman around 50. And then the other thing would be, you know, if you look at it from a holistic perspective, you know, Chinese medicine, for instance, looks at insomnia around 3 as being a problem with the liver. And so then you think about, well, that's interesting. And how do they characterize that? Is that a scientific classification? But they also see, you know, the liver is more of a metaphor for energy flow, and it often correlates with anger, you know, repressed anger. So like there's a lot of ways to view it. But one thing I try to focus on people, because, you know, it's like you can medicate that and medicate it more or less successfully, but then you create a dependency on the medications and the sleep quality goes down. There's an excellent book, actually. It's called Why We Sleep. And it's written by one of the foremost sleep experts, I think from UC Berkeley, maybe Stanford, not the naturopathic Stanford like I went to. But anyways, yeah, it's a great book for anyone who has sleep problems, Why We Sleep. But for instance, like even drinking coffee, 12 hours, coffee is still going to impact your sleep. And a lot of us are drinking it in the afternoon. Another thing that we see commonly is hypoglycemia. So a lot of people with anxiety, you know, that the eating trends in our modern world are thus. You get up in the morning, you have coffee. You don't eat anything at all.
For a little while, Jennifer's, I'd say that's true.
She's raising her hand, yeah. So a lot of people do this. We're in a hurry. You know, modern life is not conducive to health or sanity, especially now, you know, with the virus and everything else that's going on. But people aren't eating. So they're not eating a breakfast when they need their calories, you know, during the active times of the day. So all day long, they're burning any glucose stores they have. They're burning fat, which everyone thinks is great. They're going to lose weight. But the reality is that you're cranking stress hormones, right? So you're cranking cortisol, you're cranking adrenaline. And so basically those are there to, so cortisol, the primary stress hormone, is a glucocorticoid, meaning it's there to balance blood sugar. It's one of its foremost, you know, functions. So when people fast, some people for even up to 2 hours, and this even goes for people who are in especially the early stages of diabetes or insulin resistance, where they're pumping out massive amounts of insulin trying to compensate for insulin receptors that no longer work. So even those people can have hypoglycemia, and the symptoms of hypoglycemia, especially if they're not getting the glucose into the cells. So basically people not eating, running on stress, running on fumes, then at night when they go 2 hours without food, boom, cortisol comes online in the middle of the night, and then they're not going back to sleep, you know? And so stuff like that. But also, you know, I am a career insomniac. I mean, I have had problems with sleep since I was 13. You know, and I have found certain things that are helpful, supplement wise, you know, things can be helpful, but there's no magic bullet. When it comes to insomnia, the number one cause of it that I see is anxiety. And we're all anxious. We're all, you know, way too stretched out. And so anxiety, how do you deal with anxiety long-term without just suppressing it medically? You know, anxiety requires work. It requires a healthy diet. It requires eating on a regular schedule. It requires going to bed on schedule. It requires turning the house down, calming the house down, dark room, no noise. There's just so many different factors to good sleep hygiene. But, you know, teaching people even the basic, most simple ways to increase their rest and repair mode of their nervous system. And, you know, I'm a big advocate. Hey, if you're not sleeping, you should be meditating or praying, you know, doing something that calms your mind and you know, gives you a sense of peace. And, you know, I always tell people like a simple, simple thing to do is sit up in bed or go somewhere else, because you don't want anxiety, performance anxiety around the bed, and do some deep, slow breathing, you know, because that is one of our body's best ways to decrease stress. But what a lot of people do is they get up at 3 a.m. and then they go and eat something, or then they go and they smoke a cigarette, or then they go and they smoke marijuana, or then they go and, you know, give themselves some kind of reward, and in essence, conditioning waking up to do the reward. So, I mean, there's a lot of things, but again, like, you know, naturopathy, when it's successful, it's because the patient is engaged in doing the work. You know, we can't be healthy without work.
No, I think it's really good. I'm a pretty anxious person, type A personality. And in the evening, if I do a stretching routine and I turn the lights down and I kind of go through prayer and journal and gratitude and just that routine, if I keep with that, mm-hmm. I sleep so much better. And it's just calming. I don't feel the tension from whatever happened that day. It's kind of like letting that go. Like the day it's over, the day is done, and I have a new start tomorrow,
right.
You know, whatever that is. And so it's that rhythm. If I lose that rhythm, I can see where I could head into anxiety and having more sleep issues than I already have.
Yeah. You know, because the number one thing people are going to tell you is that they're waking up and their brain is just spinning. You know, you figure we spend all day long focusing on things that our work has told us that are important to us, you know, suppressing a lot of creative thought, suppressing a lot of introspection. And, you know, hey, what better time for the mind to, you know, set itself loose than at night?
Everything's worse at night.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting too, because oftentimes I'll tell people like, hey, maybe journal, you know, what you recall about your dreams every morning, even if it's just two sentences, because the more you do that, the more you tap into what's going on subconsciously. And a lot of times I think, you know, as far as, for instance, like tying into that Chinese medicine, I think that, you know, our subconscious mind comes awake and shows us things that maybe we don't want to see, and we wake up, you know, to avoid it. And again, you know, sitting down and doing the meditation and calming your mind and inducing a restful state and restful brain waves, you know, is beneficial, even if it's not sleep. And oftentimes meditation's, you know, boring enough that you just fall asleep.
Right. Yeah. You can.
Yeah. And there's a reason they counted sheep.
Right.
It was really boring, and you know, you put you to sleep.
No, that's a good point. Yeah. In terms of the IV vitamin therapy, I saw that as something else you offer. When would someone do that? Why is that something you use? How does it work?
Yeah. You know, that's been something that's evolved, you know, over the course of my whole career. You know, I've been doing IVs now for, geez, it's going on like 15 years. And originally it was kind of Wild West with IVs, and that's changed a lot. The FDA's kind of clamped down, and in some ways I'm grateful for that, because I do think it was getting so experimental that people were getting things that had not really been tested as safe on humans. And so at some point, in my practice, I decided that I was going to focus on the things that I thought were safe, and effective. And for me, our IV program here is basically focused around IV vitamin C, because I think it's got a really excellent record of being safe. And, part of that is how you administer it. And we do I do it all myself. We don't have 6 chairs. We're not running a factory. And, we don't really, it's not something where I'm packing the room every day. And I think most IV clinics, that's kind of what it is. It's, maybe curing hangovers or something like that. But for me, like IV vitamin C is useful for a number of things. We generally don't use it in every single patient, but certainly if somebody with chronic fatigue was interested in it, chronic infection that doesn't go away is oftentimes beneficial. Vitamin C has so many different activities in the body, but it's helpful for like wound repair. It's also helpful for adrenal function. It's also super helpful for vascular health, which impacts pretty much every system. Probably the most common people that would get vitamin C would be, cancer patients as an adjunct to their conventional treatment. And there's, really pretty decent evidence, not only for safety, but for the fact that it's beneficial. It improves outcomes by making treatment tolerance better. And for instance, like the University of Kansas has a pretty good program where they're, doing research on high dose vitamin C for cancer. And then one of like my pet IV products is DMSO. DMSO is FDA approved for a condition called interstitial cystitis, which is like a bladder permeability inflammatory condition. And it works very well, but it's not used because it's kind of an orphan drug. But Stanley Jacobs was the father of DMSO. He basically discovered a lot of the activities of it and studied it for like 55 years at OHSU in Portland. And he's basically responsible for getting it FDA approved. But in the 70s, he did a lot of research on DMSO. Back then, they could just do clinical research. And so he did a lot of IVs, and they used it for pain control. They used it for traumatic brain injury. They used it for spinal cord injury, cardiovascular disease. And DMSO is probably like one of the most researched compounds in the entire formulary. It's just that it's not researched as a drug. They mix things with it in vitro studies, and then they consider it inert. But the reality is that it's not inert. So all of these petri dish studies were influenced heavily by the presence of DMSO. But DMSO, like if people are interested in it, there's a web on YouTube. There's a 60 Minutes presentation from early 70s with Dr. Jacobs. And for instance, like he treats a patient that's obviously like a fibromyalgia patient. And within 3 treatments, her pain is gone. And then they come back and visit her like 6 months later and it's still gone. And DMSO is probably one of the only things I've ever seen where someone's told me that their fibro pain is gone. But cancer pain, it's effective. It just has so many different pathways that it influences, and its safety is very good as long as the dosage is proper.
What about chronic pain patients that, like in terms of spine, someone who's had maybe potentially more than one spine surgery, and they're just living with a certain level of pain. They're functioning, but is that something with the chronic pain population too that you've seen any good effects with that?
Yeah, so like our experiences with DMSO are kind of limited in that way. So I wouldn't generally recommend it for that person necessarily, because I'm not sure whether it would help. And because it's not covered by insurance either. So, to recommend it, I have to feel pretty strongly that it's going to benefit. So mostly with DMSO, we've seen, for instance, like rheumatoid arthritis controlled. And the biggest side effect is that it makes you smell funny for like a day and a half. And people are having to spend, money out of pocket. But the reality is that the biologics that, they're trying to get people to take with rheumatoid, it can be $50,000 a year.
Yeah, I have a rheumatoid patient right now that's spending quite a bit out of pocket for her medications. Yeah. And yeah. So
Yeah, it's crazy too, because we've actually had, you know, talking about like trying to coordinate with conventional docs. I mean, we've had rheumatoid patients who were doing very well just with the DMSO. And finally, I said, look, I'm concerned that we're not adequately treating this. Let's send you to a rheumatologist. Rheumatologist is like, you're not adequately treated. And then the question would be, you know, and so trying to go back and forth with this rheumatologist, what is that based on? Well, you're not on one of our drugs. Okay, well, what's the goal of the drug? The goal of the drug is to control degeneration of the joints. So I say, why don't you order an MRI? So they're hesitant, which, you know, the standard would be, well, let's look at the MRI. How's their joint? I mean, they've had this disease for 5 years. There should be degeneration if they're not adequately managed. And then finding out that, you know, their MRI is fine. You know, and yet still, there's no interest in that. You know, there's no curiosity or anything about it. It's just, no, that's not standard. It's not acceptable, even though it's effective. But for instance, that patient being on the DMSO. So the other thing for, you know, pain, you know, I wouldn't want to undersell the importance of diet.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the anti-inflammatory diet.
Like. Yeah. Yeah. And we see, you know, so this same patient was hesitant to change their diet because people are, you know, it's a lot of comfort in the diet. And it took years of DMSO, out-of-pocket expense, and finally developing the relationship where they trust me enough to try for a month, eat your vegetables, you know, do this diet for a month, and then realizing like this controls the pain better, even than the DMSO, better than the drugs, and then seeing even their inflammatory markers come down to normal. They still have rheumatoid. You know, if they started eating horribly, it would come back. But like seeing the power of that, and there's nobody in the conventional system that's going to advocate that really strongly or make that the focus.
Yeah. And it's a large behavioral change that's hard to do in one 15-minute visit.
Yeah. And it doesn't give you a 6% markup that you can collect either. You know, I mean, these biologics are profitable because they're in-house and there's a markup. So now old drugs that might have worked just fine for these conditions, inflammatory bowel disease, you know, take mesalamine, it's a fancy aspirin, you know, for your colon. Now they're launching right into, you need Remicade, you need Humira. And, you know, part of that is because they're super effective, but they're also potentially leading to cancer and severe infection. Whereas, you know, the cheaper drugs are being left behind. Diet certainly is not profitable. And you look at heart disease, I mean, a huge aspect of that in our current you know, status is diet. And even the American Cardiology Association, they recommend plant-based diet, but they don't really talk about it until you get to page 20 of their website. And the doctors certainly don't talk about it. We all know the truth. I mean, our moms knew the truth.
Yeah. I mean, we all know we're supposed to eat 10 to 12 servings of vegetables a day, but do we do it?
No.
it's hard. It's just hard work in the life that we live.
It is.
I can get 6 to 8 pretty regularly on a day, but
that's good.
On the weekends, maybe I can get to the 10, but yeah. It's hard.
It is.
Work. I feel the same way when I'm telling someone else that that's what they should shoot for. It's like, yeah, but I don't even get that myself all the time either. So it is.
I always tell people, you know, hey, if your foundation in your house was crumbling, would you paint your house or would you fix the foundation? And, you know, people want to paint the house because, and I get it, life is stressful. It's very stressful, but if we don't prioritize health, we'll pay for it.
Yeah. You'll either kind of have to suffer a little bit now to get that under control, or you're really going to have consequences later.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, things like raising children, you know, demand a lot of time, but if you're not healthy, you know,
yeah. Yeah. The other one I wanted to touch on is about the SPG blocks for headaches.
Yeah. So that's a really fun thing that we do. And it's a sphenopalatine ganglion block, which is just basically a fancy way to say spraying some lidocaine up your nose.
okay.
You know, and so they've been doing this for 100 years. You know, it's been documented for headache relief for 100 years. And there's all different kinds of torturous ways to do it. But the reality is that it's spraying, you know, some lidocaine up your nose. And for instance, like the UW Migraine Clinic, they do this procedure, but they medicalize it so much that they actually, like, we had a patient who was paying $300 out of pocket on top of what they were billing the insurance company, which they were billing it basically as a surgical procedure, despite the fact that it's spraying lidocaine up your nose. And lidocaine is a topical anesthetic. So not much different than what you get when you go to the dentist. Basically, deep inside of your sinuses, and like I said, like everyone around here has sinus problems. So it's real common that migraines are, you know, misdiagnosed. You know, there are definitely classic migraine syndromes and some people, or symptoms, and some people have those, but it's kind of become a bad headache as a migraine.
Yeah, that's kind of, when people say it, I'm like, I don't even know. I mean, are they just saying they have a bad headache, or they really have been diagnosed with migraines, and what kind of migraine? And so that was my other question, is like, what kind of migraine would this be effective for and not be effective for?
That's a good question. I mean, I know, you know, just like your standard migraine headache, everyone thus far, I don't think we've seen it fail anybody. The hard part is, you know, how do you schedule a migraine to come in and get relief? Because then you got to get in your car or have someone drive you. And then our schedule has to be open. So that makes it a little difficult. But yeah, basically, you know, inside your nose, they're called turbinates, but they're basically passageways up into your sinuses. And at the top level turbinate, there is a nerve bundle, the sphenopalatine ganglion, and you can reach that with liquid lidocaine with the person basically in a reclined position, their head tilted back. You let gravity do the work and get the lidocaine to that nerve bundle. And basically that nerve bundle has been associated with you know, causing migraines. And migraines are like a vascular dysfunction. At least that's part of the pathology or pathophysiology of migraine headaches. And pretty much what's thought is that if you can anesthetize that nerve bundle, then you anesthetize the entire pain message and you stop the pain cycle. And so generally what we see people coming in with headaches that are anywhere from, like, you know, 6 to 8 out of 10, and leaving, you know, with 1 or 2 out of 10 pain. So it's, you know, it's remarkably effective. And again, they do it, but it's not thought of as standard of care. So instead people are taking medications. But, you know, migraines also potentially can do really well with high doses of vitamin B2 riboflavin, which is actually a drug of choice. I mean, it is listed as a pharmaceutical for migraine headaches. It's never used, rarely used. And then also even like CoQ10 in large doses, you know, has good evidence. There's a lot of alternative treatment. And, you know, what we see again is like a lot of sinus headaches that are misdiagnosed. So making sure that we address that, you know, and I do think you can have a migraine triggered by muscle tension, a migraine triggered by a sinus headache, you know, so there's a lot of interplay between all those things too.
And then hormonal ones. Yeah. I mean, that's the one I struggle with. It's always cyclical. And the only, I mean, if I know what's coming on, if I don't take the Imitrex, I'm going to be in a world of hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think I figured it out when I was starting to eat Excedrin like candy for a couple of days. I'm like, this is not sustainable. And so that's when I went. So are those people, would that work for that scenario? I mean,
I think it would work. I'm trying to think if we've treated someone specifically, you know, with a hormonal migraine, and I can't think of anyone in particular, but I would be surprised if it wouldn't help. Because again, like you're undercutting like the migraine, you know, kind of at a root level, you know, at that ganglion. So, hey, stop by sometime when you got a headache, and I'll show you. It is really easy, you know, to do, and it'd be amazing if they had that available as an over-the-counter option for people, you know, so they wouldn't have to come and, you know, see a physician to have it done. But you know, and that's another thing, is like they don't pay for the procedure. The insurance company doesn't pay for the procedure, but we just you know, wrap it into the visit and just provide the service, because it's valuable and it works super well. Now I just have to figure out a way to get around the mask.
Right? Yeah, currently that's that situation. Well, yeah, exactly. And so it sounds like even if they have a tension headache from like, you know, whiplash or car, you know, like it doesn't necessarily matter the origin per se. If you can get to that ganglion, you can cut off the message that's going to the brain for the migraine. I mean, is that
tension headache might be different.
Okay.
Tension headache, because, you know, a lot of that does have to do with muscle tension, even, you know, along the skull muscles too, you know, so it's not technically going to be the same pain path as a migraine. Okay. I'd be less enthusiastic about that, but I still would try it. I still would try it because, again, like a lot of these headaches have, you know, a lot of different contributing facts. So I think it's possible that it would help, but I wouldn't promise that.
How many times do they come in? Do they just need one of that?
That's a good question. Yeah. So the way they do it at the UW Headache Clinic, and I don't know if this is based on any evidence necessarily, but it's highly profitable for them. So because I think they just have one person doing these all day long. But basically they say come in, headache or not, every week for 6 weeks. At least that was the last I had heard of how they were doing them. And the theory is that if you anesthetize that nerve bundle, you're blocking the pain pathway, you're stopping the cycle. So we have had people do that in the past, but again, like, it's difficult to get somebody to do something that's, you know, it's a little uncomfortable, a little. I mean, you know, compared to colon cancer, it's nothing, but you know, it's a little
compared
uncomfortable.
Compared to what? Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's hard to get people to do something that's uncomfortable and inconvenient if they're not having active symptoms. So we kind of have dropped that, but certainly I would try that if somebody was, you know, game for it.
I think we're ready to wrap up with some rapid fire questions.
Oh my gosh.
Our typical ones that we like to ask.
Uh-oh.
So what is your favorite restaurant in the South Sound?
That's a good question. I mean, we generally eat mostly plant-based, but sure, occasionally we get hungry for something more substantial. So, you know, I'm trying to think like where do we like, Cascadia is a good place to get a burger. And they also have meatless options. So that's kind of nice. I do not eat there routinely because I do not think it's probably the healthiest food, but it's delicious.
Yeah.
And I like the owners. They're good people, apparently. You know, if I'm eating for health, well, the co-op had a good salad bar, but they don't really have it anymore. But I used to eat there all the time. And then there's a restaurant called Miso.
Oh, I love Miso.
Yeah. You know, it's just whole foods and very simple ingredients, not a lot of garbage. And, you know, if people are curious about what it's like to eat a plant-based meal, certainly you can go and get a vegan or a veggie bowl. And, you know, it's delicious and it's healthy and it's quick and it's actually pretty inexpensive. So I like that place.
That's one of our favorites for staff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We get a lot of miso.
You guys are doing well.
What's on your bucket list to do in the South Sound that you haven't done yet?
I'm waiting for somebody who has experience to invite me to go and climb Mount Rainier. It's something I've wanted to do forever, but I have not. I don't know anybody who does that. So
that's a busy thing in the summer.
Yeah, I bet. Have you done it?
I've just gone up to Camp Muir.
Oh yeah,
in
yeah,
a day,
same,
but
same.
I haven't stayed overnight to go to the, you know, in the morning. I'm not sure that I have the drive for that. I think I'm like, I'm good.
Yeah, the training is, I think, probably a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I'm like, I think that's good. What is a favorite place or thing to do here in the South Sound outside that you would recommend everyone get out and do?
Well, I don't want them to get out and do it because then they're going to crowd it up. But yeah. But hiking, I mean, this, we have so much natural beauty here. It's just ridiculous, you know. Get out and get your heart pounding and, you know, breathe
endless,
heavy.
The number of trails that you can choose.
Yeah. I mean, if you think you're in good shape, go climb a mountain.
Right.
And you know, it's going to beat you at some point, most likely.
What is your best tip for people to stay healthy and fit? Like, what's something you find yourself saying
over
all the time to your clients that you just wish you could just plaster everywhere?
That's a good one. I mean, there's several things obviously involved in good health, but I think for most people, even if you have a bad diet and you're not going to change and you drink and you smoke or whatever, and you're not going to change, move your body. You know, the older we get, the longer it takes to recover from injury, from, you know, underuse, deconditioning, you know, move your body, even if it's standing up to watch, you know, your TV show and jumping up and down for 5 minutes, move your body.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I don't think you can be healthy or happy if you're not moving your body.
Where can people find out more about you? So like your website is called?
DocGriffith.com. Yeah. And then, you know, we're always taking new patients because, you know, as a naturopath, you know, we are primary care, but, you know, frankly, a lot of people use us as a second opinion to see if they can, you know, find another way. And oftentimes there is another way. We are located on the west side of Olympia at 420 McPhee Southwest.
Phone number, if you want to list that.
Our phone number is 360-455-8281.
Well, thanks so much for
being
on the podcast. And I think this will be helpful for people in our community. And
yeah, nice to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast, brought to you by Penrose and Associates Physical Therapy. If you want some free tips to implement right away on various problems like knee pain, back pain, running injuries, and many more issues, then jump on over to penrosept.com and download the free report that fits your needs. You will receive helpful tips right away and have the choice to email in for further questions and set up a free phone consultation. You can reach us at 360-456-1444 and info@penrosept.com. You can stay connected with us at stayhealthysouthsound.com and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast.